This podcast is supported by Tenderfoot TV. Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where the new podcast To Die For begins. Hosted by Neil Strauss, To Die For takes listeners inside the dark and dangerous world of Russian sex espionage, where targets are seduced for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, the producers of To Live and Die in LA, binge To Die For now on all podcast platforms.
Hey, everyone. It's Estelle Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
What I think makes this discussion a little bit different is I tell you unabashedly whether you like it or not. I suspect many of you do not. I will be a different president. So don't look at me within the context of past history.
Hi, I'm Katie Kingsbury from the New York Times editorial board. And welcome to The Choice, a new podcast that brings you behind closed doors and into the exclusive deliberations process around the New York Times pick for the 2020 presidential candidate. In each episode, you'll hear Democratic presidential candidates make their pitch as they interview for the biggest job of their career. Every election year, the board chooses a candidate after closed-door, off-the-record interviews and a lot of internal debate. But the stakes are so high in 2020, and we think voters deserve to hear how we decided on our pick as the best candidate to beat Donald Trump. So we're giving you access to these conversations and the debates that followed so you can make the choice for yourself. To learn more about how the board works and who's on it, go back and listen to episode 1 of this series. We've trimmed each of these interviews down, but if you'd like to read the full transcript, you can find them on nytimes.com/endorsements. That's endorsements with an S. By luck of congressional calendars and airtight campaign schedules, the first candidate to visit the Times was Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
Bernie is back. Sanders officially announced today that he's running for president again.
What's going to be different this time?
We're going to win.
Mr. Sanders is no stranger to the New York Times. The board first interviewed Sanders in 2016 when he was running against Hillary Clinton for the Democratic nomination. The appeal of Bernie Sanders is obvious. He takes a position and sticks to it, some for the last 40 years. He brings ambitious ideas, and he fights for the working class and younger generations. His 2016 campaign is largely responsible for pushing progressive ideas like Medicare for All and free college to the center of the Democratic Party's platform. But we've heard him talk about these ideas for years now, and the board needed to know how he planned to execute his ambitious proposals, especially under a Republican-led Senate.
So, Senator Sanders, thank you so much for coming. We all know your bio. We've watched the debates. Most of us have actually met you in the past. You know, we've heard you talk a lot about healthcare and the Middle East and climate. So we're hoping to focus on a few questions that we have not heard you answer on the campaign trail. Could you walk us through what the first 100 days will look like? What are your priorities? What do you want to do while you have the momentum of entering office?
It's going to be a busy 100 days. In fact, I've made enough promises that I think I'm going to be up all night on my first day. Probably going to bed at 5 in the morning. I think the most important point, aside from the legislation, which I'll get into, is to convince the American people that, in fact, we can have a government that represents working people and not just the 1%. And that will mean, by the way, that I suspect we're going to use Air Force One quite a bit. We're going to get around the country. We're not just going to be in the Oval Office. But obviously, the legislation that we're going to introduce will deal with climate change, which I consider to be an enormous threat, not only to this country, but to the planet. We'll introduce Medicare for All legislation in the first week, because I think it's high time the United States joined the rest of the industrialized world in guaranteeing health care to all people. we will be introducing legislation not dissimilar to what passed the House, raising the minimum wage to a living wage. We'll be introducing legislation to rebuild a crumbling infrastructure, making public colleges and universities tuition-free. In other words, what I believe is when you rally the American people around an agenda that works for working people, we can do more than one thing at a time. I'm asked every single day, what's your top priority? There is no top priority. The top priority is to create a government that works for all of us, not just the people on top.
That's a really ambitious agenda. What of that legislation do you think could pass the Mitch McConnell Senate?
When I talk about a political revolution, it means being an administration unprecedented, certainly in the modern history of this country, maybe going back to FDR, maybe even beyond FDR. So to me, what my administration is about is not sitting with Mitch in the Oval Office or in wherever it is, negotiating something. It is rallying the American people around an agenda that they already support. This is, I think, what makes me a little bit different than other candidates. And that is, not only will I be commander-in-chief, I will be organizer-in-chief. And I think the agenda that we have brought out in almost every respect is supported by the American people.
How do you respond to studies that show that you have one of the worst records in terms of bipartisan deal-making in the legislature right now?
Really?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I'm not quite sure I have not seen that study. You may want to go back to my role in the House, where year after year after year, guess which member of Congress got more amendments passed on the floor of the House than the other in a bipartisan way. So I don't accept that. But second of all, the point that I am making is that the way you bring about real change in this country, what the history of America is about, is when millions of people stand up for justice. So again, when I say to you, in due respect, in all respect, and I mean that, we look at the world differently. You're saying, how do I negotiate with Mitch McConnell? And I'll tell you how I negotiate. Because when the people of Kentucky are demanding to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, or health care for all, or making their schools, public colleges and universities, tuition-free, that's the basis of the negotiation. You transform. And I want to say this. 4 years ago, when I was in this room, I suspect, talking about an agenda, many of the people in this room thought that the ideas that I talked about were crazy ideas, right? Raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Bernie, don't you know? Federal minimum wage is 7.25. Who are you going to negotiate with? 7 states have passed that already, including New York State, and so has the House of Representatives. That's how change comes about. You make an offer to Mitch McConnell that he cannot refuse, and that is that the American people want to move in a different direction.
I want to give my colleagues some opportunities to ask some questions as well.
Can I just follow up on that one question? Given what we've gone through over the last 3 years, when Democrats hear about the president flying around the country holding rallies, they might cringe. And I'm wondering how you flying around the country in 2021 rallying the people would be different than what Donald Trump has been doing.
Well, I don't know if I should be insulted by that question. I've spent my life fighting against everything that Donald Trump stands for. But as I look at this country right now, what I see, and having been to virtually every state in this country, I think you have a people who are very disillusioned with the political process, which is one of the reasons we have that demagogue in the White House right now. And I think the goal of a president who speaks for the American people, who believes in the American people, is to rally them around ideas that they already believe in. So if I hold a rally, it's not to attack undocumented people or African American people, try to divide the country up. It's quite the country, to bring people together.
You know, we've talked a lot about health care reform in the debates and throughout the season, and it's obviously very important, but it's not the only thing that determines health. So what I want to talk about is, what are some of the other things that you'll focus on as president to improve the nation's health?
Great point. In fact, medical care is maybe not the most important point in determining people's health. We have to do a lot better in terms of disease prevention. I think we have to figure out a way to improve dietary habits in this country, to be honest with you. Obesity is an awful problem leading to diabetes. We have to deal better with exercise. What we also have to do is deal with issues like pollution and environmental degradation.
With respect to public health, I'm thinking about, you know, vaccine hesitancy and how you might combat that, how you would address things that are impacted by, you know, waning public health infrastructure and lack of
investment. I'm sorry.
With respect to public health, for example, vaccine hesitancy, how would you combat that? What would you do to fortify the CDC, for example?
Well, I would. I mean, I think it is, we're already seeing measles epidemics or problems arising. And we will be very aggressive in making certain that kids get the inoculations they need to prevent diseases which are contagious.
What does that mean? Does that mean requiring making vaccines requirements?
I mean, I haven't thought a whole lot about that particular issue, but it may well mean that. I mean, in other words, your kid, if you decide for whatever reason not to vaccinate your kid, and that kid goes to the school and gets my kid sick, you know, I don't grant you the right to get my kid sick.
I agree with you.
Now I'd like to turn to your health for a moment. Do you know when you plan to release your complete health records to the public?
We hope to. I want to make sure that it is complete. So we hope to do that. The goal is by the end of the year. I won't swear to you it may be a few days later or a week or two later, but we will release them fully.
Senator Sanders did actually release his health records before the end of the year, and everything checks out. He appears to be in good health.
And after the artery blockage that occurred earlier this fall, there's obviously some concern among voters about your health. What are you doing to take care of yourself now?
Thank you. My wife watches me very carefully. Don't tell her we had spare ribs last night, please. Don't let her know that. It was a good place.
This is on the record.
I'm eating better. I'm exercising. Well, not as much as I should. It's hard when you're on the campaign trail. But I am trying to do better.
Do you have a workout routine? Are you a gym rat?
I wish I did. My daughter thinks I should. I don't. And I'll tell you something, you know, you asked me a personal question. The heart attack was shocked to me, not physically, as much as it was intellectually, because I have been blessed, this is not what I know, whatever it is, with good health my whole life. I was a kid growing up in New York City, I was a long distance runner. So I could run forever. I was a pretty good runner. And the idea that my body malfunctioned on that day was shocked. I couldn't believe it when the doctor told him, I really couldn't believe it. So, to answer your question, I am going to do my best. I see it as a public responsibility. I don't have I should. And maybe my daughter is right. She's into yoga. She's a yoga instructor. She's been trying to get me to do this. You agree, right?
Sounds like you should listen to your daughter.
I think I should. I will do better. But the top problem is on the campaign, it is just so hard.
How do you answer comments by Jimmy Carter, for instance, that he wouldn't have been able to do the job of the presidency at age 80? Should there be an age limit?
No, there should not be an age limit. And look, this issue of age is a fair question. But some person who is 80 is different than other people who are 80. But it's not just age. You have to look at what have you done with your lifetime? What's your record? What do you stand for? What fights have you fought? What is your record? So I think people will look at the totality of the candidates. And I'll tell you what the advantage. If there's an advantage of being 78, is that I have been doing what I do for a long time. Now, you may like it, you may not like it. I ain't gonna change when I get to the White House. And I see that as an advantage. People know who I am, what I stand for. Some like it, some don't. But the president I will be is not different than the guy I've been for the last 30, 40 years.
So now you were talking about the totality of your experiences. Looking at the totality of the ticket, so to speak, who is on your short list for running mate? Kind of what factors
do you want to be vice president? Is this what you're asking me?
You know, I can't imagine that job.
All right, let me just say this. I think it's a little bit premature. It will not be an old white guy. I think Joe has had 8 years as vice president, probably enough. I believe in diversity. I believe and know that my administration and my cabinet will look like America looks like. So I'm not gonna tell you who it's gonna be. We haven't considered that yet. But I think country is long overdue for the kind of diversity that we're gonna bring to the White House.
So you've declined to support reparations. What, if anything, should the federal government do to address the condition specifically of Black Americans after centuries of discrimination, exclusion, and plunder, frankly?
Yes, you're right. It's not that I have rejected reparations. I am on Cory Booker's bill in the Senate, which looks at reparations. I'm a co-sponsor of that, strong co-sponsor of that. What I believe is you're absolutely right. And that means I am sympathetic to what Jim Clyburn of South Carolina is talking about. I don't know if you're familiar with what Clyburn is talking about. It's called the 10-20-30 legislation. And what it says is the federal government must substantially increase funding for distressed communities that have long-term poverty rates, often, not always, African-American communities. And that means a significant increase in federal funding for housing, for education, for healthcare, for infrastructure, for job training. You're absolutely right. There is no argument. There are community, African-American community. We don't even have to go into all the horror that that community has experienced, and that has got to be addressed. And we intend to address it in an extremely bold way. That's a promise I make to you.
During the 2016 campaign, Senator Sanders argued several times that lower wages for American workers are tied to an influx of immigrants. But most experts on the matter say that immigration actually increases economic growth. It doesn't affect the wages of the American worker or their employment rates. Even George Borja, the Harvard economist whom the Trump administration cites to argue that immigration drives down wages, says there's no economic justification for restricting skilled immigration. We needed to follow up.
You've announced proposals to, I guess, essentially freeze deportations, to decriminalize border crossings, and to provide a pathway to citizenship. But you've also said that guest workers and undocumented immigrants can lower wages for low-skilled American workers. I was wondering if you still felt that way.
No, and when you that's what on. I said on the Lou Dobbs show 250 years ago, right? Gets repeated a little bit. Look, I think if you look at the proposal that we have, and I speak as the son of an immigrant, what we do on day one is end all of Trump's racist immigration executive orders. We undo them. And on day one, we restore legal status to the 1.8 million young people and their parents eligible for the DACA program, okay? Number two, through executive order, we are gonna totally change our attitude on the border. Under my administration, federal agents will not be snatching babies from their mothers, will not be throwing children into cages. And number three, and I believe we can do this, I can't swear to you, because it is going to require bipartisan support. But I think the American people do want comprehensive immigration reform and a path toward citizenship, and I will push that as strongly as I can. And I think there is a bipartisan support for that. So I think you're raising an issue, though, that we don't talk about a whole lot when we talk about immigration, and that is the exploitation of undocumented workers. If you don't have any documentation, I can hire you for $5 an hour. And what recourse do you have? Not much. And that is an issue that our labor law reform, by the way, does deal with.
But you don't think that that exploitation results in lower wages for domestic workers?
Sure it does. Right now, if people are being exploited, if you're undocumented and you're being paid $5 an hour, why am I going to pay her $12 an hour?
I'm confused.
And that's why the labor law that I am proposing will make sure you pay that worker $15 an hour, as a matter of fact.
But what you said on the Lou Dobbs show is that that exploitation lowers wages, and you just said that again, so I'm confused about what has changed about your position.
What did I just say again?
You said that the exploitation of undocumented workers
if you're being
results
paid $5,
in lower wages
if you're being paid $5 an hour now, of course that's going to lower wages. Why would I hire her at a higher wage?
But just a minute ago, you said that was no longer your position. Is it your position that immigration and
no,
the
I didn't
exploitation...
say immigration. I said that if you are paid, anybody is paid, exploited, and illegally paid low wages, of course that's going to lower wage standards in America.
There's a lot of economic research suggesting that it does not.
Not that I have seen.
Okay.
I mean, I think that's kind of common sense. It's called the race to the bottom.
You've long supported movements in Latin America to oppose American intervention and oppressive regimes there. Why do you think it is that so many of the leftist governments that have taken power in the last few years, despite the hopes that many American leftists had that they would bring about change, have become anti-democratic, corrupt, and even brutal?
Well, for a start, compared to what? what I have opposed my whole life is U.S. interventionism and overthrowing governments, all right? As you are familiar with, the United States has a long history under the so-called Monroe Doctrine of overthrowing governments. I don't think that that's right. It's just Big Brother thinking they have the right to intervene whatever they wanted in Latin America. Now, you raise an interesting question. First of all, when we talk about recent governments, Lula, who I talked to a couple of weeks ago, we can argue it. I'm not telling you I'm the world's greatest expert, but I suspect the case against him was an illegitimate case.
What was legitimate? Or
was illegitimate. All right. I think he was jailed. He was, before the election in which Bolsonaro won, Lula, as I recall, was the most popular politician in Brazil. And he had a pretty good record. And there was a charge, which I suspect was trumped up, to get him out of the election, which resulted in an extreme right-wing Trump ally winning. In terms of Evo Morales, his record was a pretty good record. He went a long way to limit or to cut back on extreme poverty in a very poor country, give a voice to the indigenous people of that country. Should he have run for another term, although they made it legal? Probably not. But, you know, within the context of what? Mexico, where you have drug cartels, massive amounts of corruption in terms of other countries. So I'm not quite sure I accept the basic premises. Lula, I think, did a good job in Brazil. I think Morales probably should not have run again, but his record is not a bad
Nicaragua.
Record. Ortega is a good exception to the rule, who came to power way back when, in the 80s, and has since become a dictator. And I think that's unfortunate. But don't only look to leftist governments. Our friend Mr. Bolsonaro in Brazil is now destroying the entire lungs of the world, if you like, and attacking gays. So, you know, it's not just left-wing governments that have misbehaved, I think, in Latin America.
Who would be on your shortlist for nominees to the court, both under a Democratic-led Senate and under a Republican Senate?
The promises that I've made so far is that I will never appoint anybody who is not 100% Roe v. Wade. I believe women have the right to control their bodies, not the governor. And in general, I think, especially in recent years, the Supreme Court, despite what they may say, what Justice Roberts and others may say, they are a very political group of people. And too often they are beholden to right-wing special interests and corporate interests. So the person that I would appoint would not only be 100% Roe v. Wade, would be somebody who understands the plight of the working class in this country, who is prepared to stand up to the power of corporate interests.
Can you give us any names?
No.
How would you get anyone with that sort of ideology past a Republican-led Congress?
Well, again, that's the same question we started off the discussion with.
It's an important question.
Yeah, well, it is an important question. And the answer is you fight for that person. And you make the case to the American people, not that I've appointed that person, not just because I like him or her, but these are the values that that person has and why we need that person on the Supreme Court. And then I think you put it into a broad context. Again, what I think makes this discussion a little bit different is I tell you unabashedly whether you like it or not. I suspect many of you do not. I will be a different president. So don't look at me within the context of past history. What I will do is tell the American people that we have by a 5-4 vote this Supreme Court, or most of those members, gave us Citizens United. The American people think it's a good idea that billionaires can buy elections. You know what? They don't. The Janus decision. Wiping out the Voting Rights Act. So the day after, you got racist governors engaged in voter suppression. All right? So you've got to put it in a context. Now, Roberts, oh, we're not political. We don't know whether Democrats were Republicans. We're not liberals, conservatives. We just interpret the Constitution. You know what? I don't believe it. And I will take that case to the American people.
Senator, I have a related question for you. Speaking of the Supreme Court, I'm wondering how closely you're following the big abortion case that the court has agreed to take up in March, and what your biggest concern is about how that case could be decided.
Well, I think everybody who is pro-choice is worried that there is now a 5-4 with Kavanaugh majority who could eviscerate Roe v. Wade.
Do you think that is a likely outcome for this case?
Or? I hope to God it is not. I mean, I'm not going to speculate, but I think, yeah, there is a reasonable chance that that could happen.
If something like that were to happen, what would you do executively to protect reproductive rights?
Everything that we possibly could. I have been 100, I think my record is 100% throughout a long lifetime of politics, believing that a woman's right to choose is a constitutional right of privacy. As president, I would move to codify Roe v. Wade, and it's a tough issue. I would significantly increase funding for Planned Parenthood. You know, and the difficulty here, the painful reality, is that for women who have money, they will be able to get an abortion. If you don't have money, you may not be able to. And that is so wrong. So all that I can tell you, it's not just to, you know, from the top of my head, I will do everything I can in every way that I can. Something I believe very strongly, it is women, not the government, who have a right to control their own bodies.
More from our interview after a quick break.
This podcast is supported by the new Porsche Panamera. When you follow the crowd, you lose something that few possess. Originality. By forging your own path and embracing the unknown, living fearlessly, without limits or reservations, and trusting your instincts, you'll chart a brave new course of your own. The new Porsche Panamera. Choose boldly.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome back to The Choice. We wanted to ask the candidates questions that they never hear on the trail, to throw them off their game a bit and get a sense of whom they are as people outside their prepared talking points. Senator Sanders wasn't too eager to play ball, but he came around.
I hope you don't mind if I ask you a couple of more personal questions. Can you give us an example of one person who has broken your heart?
What, on a personal level?
Yeah.
No, I won't. Even candidates for president of the United States have a limited amount of privacy. So.
For millions of Americans, the church and religion are center of their communities. Do you believe in God? Who are your spiritual advisors?
I am Jewish. I am proud to be Jewish. I was bar mitzvahed from the King's Highway Jewish Center a long time ago. I am not actively involved in organized religion. I believe in God. I believe in the universality of people, that what happens to you impacts me. And I certainly believe in the constitutional right of freedom of religion, and I will strongly defend that. And by the way, what that means is that we will end the Muslim ban in this country imposed by Donald Trump. Because I think people in this country have the right to freely enjoy the religions and participate in religious life that they choose to.
Do you think that faith or spirituality will play any role in the leadership that you bring to the country?
Well, it's a big issue. I mean, what do we mean by faith? You know, sure. You have some right-wing guys who think that God has told them that Muslims shouldn't come into this country, or that their religion says that women can't have access to reproductive rights, and they're not going to fund that, or they're not going to serve a gay couple a wedding cake, right? That's a religious rights, you know. So it's a big question. But I believe, you know, I was just actually in a church in South Carolina on Sunday. And what I said is that if you look at the Bible, what is the major provisions that Christ and religious leaders all over the world have talked about? Not that complicated. Do unto others as you would like them to do unto you. All right? I believe that. And in many respects, that's exactly what our campaign is based on. It is based on justice. So when you ask me about my religious views, that is what I believe. I believe that all human beings share a common humanity, no matter the color of our skin or where we were born. I think we have common dreams and aspirations for our kids. And I believe that very, very strongly. And I detest, of all the things that I hate about Trump, what I detest maybe most is, in an unprecedented way, certainly not like George Bush at all, very conservative guy, What Trump is trying to do is intentionally divide us up based on the color of our skin. This was the champion of the Bertha movement. You're familiar with that in New York, all right? This is a guy who is demonizing the undocumented. This is a guy who has imposed the Muslim ban. This is a guy who is at war against the transgender community. He is trying to divide the American people up. I detest that because I believe exactly the opposite. I believe we have a common humanity and that we've got to come together around an agenda that works for all of us.
One last thing for me. This calls for you to be a little self-critical. Are you likely to fail at or to do poorly as president?
Talk to the New York Times. Look, I don't tolerate bullshit terribly well. And I come from a different background than a lot of other people who run the country. I'm not good at backslapping. I'm not good at pleasantries. If you have your birthday, I'm not going to call you up to congratulate you, so you love me and you write nice things about me. That's not what I do. Never have. I take that as a little bit of a criticism, self-criticism. I've been amazed at how many people respond to, "Happy birthday! Oh, Bernie, thanks so much for calling." You know, it works. It's just not my style. I try to stay focused on the important issues facing working families in this country, and I fight for them.
Recently, President Obama made remarks around cancel culture and this idea.
Around what?
Cancel culture. Cancel culture.
Cancel culture. Are you
aware of that
phrase? Help me out a little bit. Give me a hint.
So cancel culture essentially is often attributed to younger people, millennials, and this idea that if you put out a critique of a public figure and call for either the resignation or for their cancellation, thing. And so President Obama said that he considers that, quote unquote, not activism. Where do you stand on this? Is that something you're concerned about in terms of the way it's energized a certain segment
of the base? I think you got a Twitter world out there. And the critique has been made, which I think has truth to it, that the Twitter world does not necessarily reflect where the American people are or even where most Democrats are. The appeal that I make to young people is twofold. First of all, the good news is, and it is very good news, is that our younger generation today is the most progressive young generation, I suspect, in the history of this country. It is anti-racist, anti-sexist, anti-homophobic, anti-xenophobic, anti-religious bigotry. It is very, very, very concerned about climate change. It has led the effort in terms of gun safety legislation. And we're seeing a lot of activity. I mean, you're seeing young people, not only in this country, but all over the world, lead the effort on climate change. And I hope we'll talk about that issue of climate change. So you got a great generation of young people out there. So, you know, I suspect the president is right. That's not enough to send out an email or a tweet or whatever it may be. Is we need a level of political consciousness and political participation in this country that we have never seen before. That's how we defeat Trump.
In his 2016 campaign against Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders had a lot of support from young people who, quote, felt the burn. But he'll also turn 79 before the general election, so we wanted to assess his understanding of the rapidly evolving tech world.
I'd love to ask a couple of lightning round questions about your relationship with technology. I know. I'm the geek squad. Do you personally use any social media?
Yeah, I have. I most of the stuff that comes out. Look, let me answer. It's not going to be in 12 characters. It'll be a longer answer. I am not a geek, but I understood way back when the power of social media. And that is why my Senate office, you can check it out. I don't, can't remember exactly. I think we have more followers on my Senate office than probably almost all the Democratic senators combined. And while I worry very much that Trump has 60 million followers on Twitter, right? I think, have reached the 10 million level. So I take it very seriously. Have I tweeted? I sure have.
Yeah, what about you personally?
Yeah, I have, absolutely. Every now and then, not so much lately, but when I had the time, I did. Yes,
I did. Do you have a Mitt Romney-esque sort of secondary account that you...
No.
No lurker accounts?
No.
So what's an app on your phone that you have that might surprise people?
Nothing.
Do you have any apps on your phone?
I read a lot, including the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Guardian, Wall Street Journal, and some progressive publications. So I go to them in my own way.
Mm-hmm. I ask because, these products play massive roles in people's lives, and as well as the devices. I mean, one issue that we're all thinking about all the time is security, especially as a candidate. I mean, do you have two-factor authentication set up on your phone?
There is a woman in my office whose name is Melissa, who drives me crazy and gets angry at me all the time. Again, we take that issue very seriously, and she works on my phone and my iPad, my computer, as she does for the whole office. So it is, in fact, I was briefed maybe a month ago by the FBI, on the dangers there.
So. I'm curious, do you think, we're seeing a lot of people, especially of a younger age, spending so much time on their screens. Do you think smartphones are addicting? Do you think that we have a problem?
I worry about it. Yeah, I do. I'm not a psychologist here, and I know there have been a number of studies on the issue, but I know that when my grandchildren come over to the house, my wife gets angry at them because they're looking at the damn machines rather than talking to anybody else. And I do worry about the long-term implications. This is a fairly new development in human history, right? And I don't know what it's going to mean to a generation that's grown up on these machines. I'm old-fashioned maybe, and I think that sometimes it's a good idea to look people in the eye and communicate face to face. It's kind of what makes us human beings. And I'll tell you what I do worry about. I do worry about having to communicate in short sentences. I was just told by my staff the other day that press releases, which I grew up in politics, are now obsolete. You don't read them anymore because you get so many of them. And the only thing that you will respond to is a tweet. So I think that's not a good thing.
I want to talk a little bit about big tech. How is your plan for reigning in big tech different than Senator Warren's? It seems like you've sort of said that you agree with a lot of that, but how are you going to differentiate yourself
on
that?
Well, look, all I can tell you is that, and I don't have the numbers in my head right now, but Amazon, what do they control, 50% of the internet economy? Is that what it is?
Well, depends what you're looking at.
You have Facebook and Twitter, Google, an enormous amount of the advertising that is done online. These are very, very serious problems. And I think one of the things where, as a nation, and this is tough stuff, okay, let me be the first to admit it, but we have been derelict in that we have antitrust legislation that has not been enforced by Republican or Democratic administrations, and I intend to do that. And it is not just the big tech companies. It is Wall Street, where you have six companies that have assets equivalent to half of the GDP in this country, and they are bigger today. Many of them are bigger today than they were before we bailed them out. It is agribusiness, where you're seeing massive mergers that make it very difficult for family farmers to survive. So we're looking at an economy where in sector after sector, and media, where you have a small number of media conglomerates. And I think we have to take a look at antitrust legislation to bring more competition to the market.
Senator, the federal government currently applies a fairly simple standard in antitrust cases. If it's good for consumers, it's good. If it's bad for consumers, it's bad. You seem to be suggesting that's not broad enough. How specifically would you define a new antitrust standard? What should be the measure for deciding that a corporation is causing harm?
When you have six financial institutions in this country having assets of over $10 trillion, when we were forced to bail them out because their illegal behavior nearly destroyed the economy in 2008, I think we should break them up. When you have Amazon controlling 50% or whatever it is of online business, I think we should be breaking them up. So I can't give you a formula here. I'm not sitting around the table with antitrust lawyers. But I think right now we have a very serious problem in terms of concentration of ownership in industry after industry, not just big tech, but in many other industries as well. So if you're telling me that if there's one company out there or two companies that are providing low prices to consumers, that that's good enough, I don't accept that. I surely do not accept that. You go into Walmarts, I guess you can get prices that are pretty reasonable, but they're paying their workers starvation wages, and as taxpayers, we are bailing them out because workers, they have to go on Medicaid and food stamps that I have to pay for and you have to pay for. That's owned by the wealthiest family in the country. So, no, the criteria for me is not just low wages by any means. You got to look at the broad impact of what that concentration of ownership means for the industry as well.
Yeah, let's talk about climate for a minute. I think we all agree in here in this room that it's a crisis. It's both a chronic crisis and an acute crisis. And you see by the growing numbers of very expensive natural disasters. The Green New Deal sets long-term goals, but what would you do in the short term? What would be the first priority?
I was criticized, not that I read the New York Times and it's sensitive to criticism, but you had an article, I don't know if you saw it, that Bernie Sanders' idea is supported by people, but not the experts. And half of your experts ended up working for the fossil fuel industry. I know that you don't write those articles. Look, the first thing that we have to recognize, and I'm reading a couple of books right now on this issue, is this is a major, major, major crisis. And what the scientists are now telling us is they underestimated the severity and the degree to which climate change is ravaging this world. And if you're looking at a 4-degree increase, centigrade, increase in temperature by the end of this century, we were on track to doing it, you're not looking at the world that you know today. You're looking at major cities in this country and all over the world. You know all that stuff.
Right.
All right.
So what do we do?
You do everything humanly possible. That's what you do. You do it and you understand that climate change is the equivalent of a major attack. All right. If we were attacked by a country today, all right, the president would say we're in a state of war. Well, we are in a state of war against climate change. And instead of denying the reality like Trump does, or making it worse by encouraging more fossil fuel, I will lead the world, because this is not the make, what makes the problem more complicated is not just an American issue, is it? It's an issue of China and India and Brazil. And we have got to lead the world to radically transform our energy system. So what I say, to answer your question, the most fundamental thing that we do is say to the fossil fuel industry, sorry, your short-term profits are not more important than the future of this planet. We're going to phase you out as quickly as we possibly can. That means massive investments in wind, solar, energy efficiency, transportation. It means leading the world and helping those countries.
Would you rejoin the Paris Accord?
Yeah.
Would
that's
you,
nickel and dime.
Would you?
I get it. No, let me just say this. Why rejoin the Paris Agreement? Yeah. So what? That doesn't mean anything. You got to go far, far, far beyond where the Paris Agreement was. We are talking about the likelihood that your grandchildren or children may be living in an increasingly unhealthy and dangerous world, okay? Paris Agreement is fine. That doesn't mean anything. The world has got to understand that we need bold and aggressive action now if we're going to save this planet. That's what I believe.
So now politics is about priorities. It sounds like this would be...
This is a major priority. How could it not be a priority?
If not your signature issue, at least one of the ones.
I reject the signature issue. I mean, I believe that members of Congress and the American people can chew bubblegum and walk at the same time. Saving the planet, yeah, I guess that's a signature issue.
I've seen no evidence of that, that they can chew gum and walk at the same time.
Well, I'm asking you to look, I'm going to make you false promises. What I am saying here is I intend to do things differently than it has been done in the past. And in terms of climate change, there is no choice. I was criticized by everybody in the world. I came up with a $16 trillion program. And your writer here said, oh, the experts don't agree with Bernie. You tell me the alternative. What's the alternative to spending as much as humanly possible to save the planet? You got a better idea than I do? So we work with the scientific community. We work with the engineers. I don't have all the answers. But all I am telling you, you tell me what is a higher priority than saving the planet.
That was the majority of the editorial board's interview with Senator Bernie Sanders. To read the entire conversation, visit nytimes.com/endorsements. That's endorsements with an S. To hear what the board had to say after Bernie left the room, and a breakdown explainer of Medicare for All and all the healthcare solutions Democrats have to offer, check out the deliberation episode. It's also out today. The Choice is produced by At Will Media. Mitch Bluestein, Molly Socha, Ashley Taylor, and Rachel Leitner, with help from Michelle Mason. Mixing by Lauren Gardner, and original music by Allison Leighton Brown. Special thanks to Tyson Evans from The New York Times. Our executive producers are Will Malnati from At Will Media and Phoebe Lett from The New York Times. Finally, we want to hear from you. Please rate and review us on the Apple Podcasts app. It'll help more voters find the show.